Hey, it's Bill Simmons. Thanks for checking out this feed of my favorite interviews and best guests over the last 7 years. Whether it's your first time or you're already in a deep dive, make sure you head to BillSimmonsInterviews.TheRinger.com for the entire archive. You can sort by genre, year, and more to easily navigate all your favorite people. Again, that is BillSimmonsInterviews.TheRinger.com. Enjoy.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. Matt Damon is here. The last podcast we did, which was a year ago.
Was it that long already?
One of the most popular podcasts I've had in the last like 5 years.
And oh, good.
I feel like this is, as a sequel, I don't want this to be like Fletch 2.
I didn't even know they made Fletch 2.
Some of the other bad sequels. I'm hoping.
Don't say like, any of mine.
I don't think it'll be Godfather 2. You don't do sequels. I guess you just did Born.
Born in Oceans.
Oh. What was the most maligned Oceans sequel?
The second.
But now it's, I thought it's come around now.
I think it has. It was Soderbergh's favorite of them.
Yeah.
So,
but people were mad when it came out because it was too meta.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I haven't seen it. And I mean, I would have to go back and watch it. But right, it was that thing of Julia Roberts playing herself and,
right.
And Bruce Willis, or thinking her character was Julia Roberts, mistaking her. Yeah, people just, I think.
What year was that?
We shot it in 04.
Yeah, because that was right. So the last 15 years, and then when Twitter became involved, really people just getting pissed off about movies and—
Well, people were probably always that pissed off.
Yeah, they just had a place.
Right, just had a place to voice it. Yeah, yeah. I had no idea how mad people were.
What was the maddest people have been at a Matt Damon movie? Probably Ocean's 12, right?
I don't know. I don't
Bagger Vance?
I mean, I certainly have my own feelings about it. It's hard. It's all, you know, it's that thing. It's so hard to make a good movie and you don't work any less hard, nor do the hundreds of people who work on the movies. You don't work any less hard on the movies that aren't good.
Yeah.
Right. It really is the same workload. It's not like the great ones require more. It's just that they came together, you know, in a way that the others didn't. But
Downsizing was one that people weren't sure about, and now it seems like that's coming around a little.
Oh, I wouldn't know. You'd know better than I would. Yeah. I love it. I mean, it's Alexander Payne is one of the great filmmakers on the planet. And look, he totally delivered for me. What he said to me was he was going to make a Hal Ashby movie with special effects.
Yeah.
And that's what that movie is. And I don't know if it just wasn't what people were expecting, which means maybe we were a little too tricky in the marketing by I think people might have been expecting like me and Wig to just be downsized and to be like zoinks, they're small, you know, and if you set people's expectations up for something then you don't deliver that, they're going to be disappointed, and that really is, and that's fair. You should show them the movie that you made, you know what I mean? You should sell them the movie as it is, you know. You shouldn't try to do a bait and switch, which I don't think we were doing. I think the idea was we want to save the reveal that she doesn't downsize. She chickens out. And it was like this great reveal when you read the script. And it was really funny. And suddenly this guy is a bachelor living in Leisureland in a condo. And it's like, and he's 5 inches tall, right? And he's got to put his life back together. And so, but I don't think anybody saw it because it's just such a dramatic left turn. And he falls in love with a one-legged Vietnamese political dissident. And, you know, there's that great line that I have in the, you know, I'm going to paraphrase it, but like, who would have thought like 10 years ago that I'd be, going down the, in a Norwegian fjord, going to meet the great, and I named the scientist with it. And it's just the most ridiculous thing that, and he's 5 inches, I'm 5 inches tall. And I'm going, it's this, and that's what I loved about it. It was unlike any other movie that I'd ever seen. And that's what I think movies should be. They should push us, a little bit and entertain, but they have to entertain us too. And in that case, I don't know. I mean, I had lunch with Alexander afterwards and kind of an after action taco down at Tacos Por Favor. Give them a little plug. Just sitting there at Tacos Por Favor going like, what happened, man? Like, boy, that didn't work. Like, what was it? But the thing about great directors, legitimately great directors, is every shot in that movie is so meticulously designed. Like, it's going to age well. It really is the best expression of that idea. It just seems that people weren't interested in that story.
We just did a Rewatchables podcast on The Shining, which is basically almost 40 years old, summer 1980.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that that movie like basically bombed. And people were mad when it came out and they didn't understand it and get it. And it took like 8 years.
Well, Stephen King apparently still, he didn't like it.
He was furious.
Right.
He felt like totally betrayed by it.
But I never read the book, so I can't speak to what he might've been upset about, but it always just surprised me because it's such an iconic movie and it really, and Kubrick. I mean, I have a few different Shining stories that I love. I don't know how much time we have, but
we have a lot of time. What do you mean? How do you have Shining stories? You were in The Shining.
But I worked with the production designer who the last film he did was The Talented Mr. Ripley, and he was Kubrick's guy, and he told me this great story about when he was designing that movie. Stanley Kubrick had a scale model of the Overlook Hotel?
Yeah.
The Overlook Hotel in their production office. And they would stand around, and this is like 1978 or 9, and he would set these lights on, to shoot this little hotel. He would set miniature lights, and he would get them. He would take hours doing this while his production heads were standing around. And then he'd take a photograph. And then he'd hand it to an assistant who would go and run off. And this is before 1 hour photo. He'd go run off and develop it and come back with an 8x10. And Kubrick would look at it for about 5 minutes. And then he'd put it down and he'd go back and he'd start setting the lights. And this is Roy Walker telling me this story. And the legendary guy. And this process would go on for days. But what Roy said was, what was incredible was when you were on the set, Kubrick had come up with some algorithm by which he could kind of transpose the numbers of the lights. So he would get he would set it just how he wanted, and then he would record what each light was at. He knew his sources were coming from exactly the same place in the big world when he did it. And he came up with this algorithm by which he could just go, and he had all the things set, and he would just set the lights up. And Roy said you could hold the 8x10, stand in the hallway, hold the 8x10 in front of your face and pull it away, and you would see the exact same thing that he'd shot on the miniature model, which is just like the level of artistry / insanity and obsession is just so beautiful.
I mean, that's why people are convinced that all of these different things are in that movie, because their whole point is like, this guy was a genius and a lunatic and every single thing was in there for a reason.
Yeah.
So there's like, people think it's about, the Native American genocide, and there are like all these different clues. Yeah. And one of them is this, I think it's coffee or something, but it's calumet, and it's like an Indian chief on the can, and he turns it in ways so that it kind of mirrors what's happening with the characters and people, but there's actual video of him moving the cans in this little random
refrigerator. No, there's nothing
refrigerator.
That, like, so to bring downsizing back into it, watching how meticulous Alexander is about everything in his frame. There's no, any of these directors, there's nothing arbitrary that's in a frame of a movie. There's nothing that hasn't been thought about. There have been meetings and conversations about every color, every single thing in that entire palette that's being presented to you has been discussed for hundreds of hours.
So do you think they see that in their head, almost like a little kid, like with a short story in their head, and they just
have to hit the beats that's in their head? I wonder what the
process is. I think people do it, they all do it really differently. You know, yeah. I think some people work thematically and they go, well, here we want this kind of light in this because this is the characters in this place. And they're kind of going through the character and the prism of what's happening for the character. And everything's extending out of that. And other people probably, like Kubrick, I don't know what was happening in his brain.
Well, it's probably the weird photo stuff. And like he probably had every frame sketched
out. I know that. I've heard like David Fincher, who's Soderbergh's best friend. So I've done 8 movies with Soderbergh, but I have never worked with Fincher. But Ben worked with Fincher. Affleck did.
For Gone Girl.
Yes. And so I went down and visited the set one day. And what I've heard from both Steven and from Ben, having worked with him, is it's Fincher has that Kubrick thing. Like, he can't unsee what he sees.
Yeah.
Right. And so I sat behind him one day while he was directing, and it was this scene where Ben and Rosamund Pike walk into this bookstore. And so the camera was down the aisle of books. So it sees them down the aisle, open the door, come in. And then as they walk down, the camera dollies with them at the far end of the bookstore and walks down. And then they eventually enter an aisle. The camera stops. They enter up the aisle towards the camera, and they end up kissing each other in this section of the bookstore. So it's like probably a 90-second shot,
yeah, right,
while they're talking. And when the camera rolled, like, Fincher's got this big monitor in front of him with you know, it's everything is time, everything is exactly as it's going to appear in the movie. And he's set all these levels himself, and he's sitting there and I'm behind him, and I've got headphones on so I can hear the scene. And he calls action. They call background, which is for the extras, the people in the bookstore. And then they call action. So when he calls background and then action, a background actor walks across the frame. All right. Then Ben and Rosamund enter the bookstore, and the scene's about to start. But Fincher is already monologuing. He's going, "Who the fuck walks like that?" And it's the background artist that just instantly caught his eye. He goes, "I mean, what the fuck was that? What the fuck? Who the fuck walks like that? Nobody walks like that." Now Ben and Rosamund are on the other side of this bookstore, and they're doing the scene. But Fincher's just still talking about this. And I'm sitting here going, like, oh, my God, they're definitely going to do the scene again.
Yeah.
Like, this take is completely...
It's shot.
It's just shot. And so they get through the whole scene. They're acting their hearts out. It's great, but it doesn't matter because the scene ended before it began. And Fincher goes, "Cut," and he takes the headphones off. He's like, "I mean, what the fuck was that?" And he looks at me. Now I know what he's talking about. The background artist was told to go from point A to point B, and they were not thinking about anything other than going from point A to point
B. Like a zombie.
And it looked ridiculous. He's not wrong, but it's just not worth, it's like, okay, just make a note of that. But it just ruined the whole thing for him. And we're sitting there, and as we're talking, a makeup artist comes on because Rosamund's still in the frame and she's going to like powder her forehead or whatever. She comes on and David goes, "I mean, that's how you walk." Like, you know, because she had a place to go. She had a reason to go there, right? And so she's not thinking about walking. She's thinking about, I gotta do my touch up. I only have about 10 seconds. I got to get out. We got to do the scene again. So I think, you know, and I think for people like that, it's almost like a curse, you know? Like, I remember when he made, with the famous Swedish books, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
And I asked Steven, the movie was going to come out within a month. And I was like, how was it? I read the books. I'm dying to know. I mean, and Steven goes, "I haven't seen it yet." I'm like, "What are you talking about? He hasn't shown it to you yet? Like, of all people?" And he goes, "No, I literally think there's like a monitor, a computer screen in one shot in the background. And he's still trying to set the level of that." Like, he goes, "He can't unsee what he sees, you know?" And that's the genius, right? It's, I mean.
What'd you think of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I haven't seen it yet. Because I was shooting, not for any other reason other than I was on set in France. And
so you don't want a blog post headline tomorrow? Matt Damon refuses to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
No, I'm dying to see it, actually.
Well, that's your rival, Leo. I've been trying to start that rivalry forever.
I don't think it's
going to
start.
You know where I am. I'm Team Damon.
Well, thank you, man.
No, I've been there forever.
He's a great guy, though. He's lovely.
Departed, you guys went head-to-head.
We did. I had a ball working with him. He's great. And that movie was when if you gave me what movies am I most excited about coming this fall, it was like that and The Irishman. I was just dying to see those.
The reason I was interested in what you thought of it was because the Brad Pitt part was, I mean, he's amazing in it, and
he's,
you know him,
amazing.
And you have a whole history with him. But that part, it would have been interesting in different people's hands. You were one of the people, you could have played, I think, either part in that movie, or at least made a run at it.
I have to see it.
But there's not a lot of like great A-list parts like that.
No, there's not a lot of great A-list parts because movies are changing. The nature of movies are changing, are in the middle of changing because of the disappearance of the DVD.
Well, this movie you're in now, which I'm going to talk about in a second, I think has two really good parts. But Talented Mr. Ripley was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like December.
And when that's it came out, we shot it 21 years ago.
Yeah. And that's a movie that I'm positive would not get made now. Or if it got made now, it would be all actors nobody had ever heard of.
Yeah, but I mean, even then it was hard to make. I mean, we made it for $37 million, which was a really, that's not a big budget for that movie, for the scale that that movie has. I mean, we were working 6-day weeks and working long, long hours. I mean, that was a labor of love for everybody who did it, definitely.
It's on cable a lot, which means... Now, though, the young people don't even watch cable anymore, but it seems
they don't know what that is.
There's still an audience for it.
Right.
Which I think seeing that movie in 1999, I would not have guessed that that movie was going to have legs. I thought it was great, but I was surprised by the rewatchability of it.
Oh, that's good to know. It's good when they're rewatchable. I always thought that's how you should judge the movies, right? It's like
it's got to be part of it. Yeah, the Martian's like that, too. The Martian's really rewatchable.
Give it more time. You never know.
The Bourne movies?
Yeah.
What's the most rewatchable Bourne movie, though? What was your favorite? Come on, you can pick now. You're almost 50.
I always really liked the second one. I think the third one was kind of hit the zeitgeist the most. It was like the right movie for that time. It kind of, we were riding on it all. We had kind of the wind at our backs for the third. But the second one, I always liked it because it was really dark. Her getting killed at the beginning and it was unexpected, especially after we took all this, it was like we had to fight to get her in the first one, right? Because it's like, well, who is she? She's European. And Doug Liman, who directed it, to his credit, said, I don't buy this American guy with amnesia being over in Europe and bumping into another American. Like, what's that? Like, that's crazy. And I think, you know, and I remember at the time it was like Jennifer Lopez was interested and there were like big names that were interested in that role. And Doug really fought to have a lesser known European actress. And she was amazing. And so you go to all that, you know, you fight for somebody who you believe in because she's great. And then it all works out and she proves to be like one of the best parts of the movie. So you start the second one with her getting killed. It was really surprising. But it was also the only way to get that character going again. Right. Because he's like, I'm out and I have this and I have a reason to live. And so it's like, it propels that. It's propulsive, right? And then you're also with him because you're pissed off too because you love her too, right? But at any rate, it goes from that kind of out of a canon start to, and it ends with an apology. He ends up going to this person and taking responsibility for what he did. And
that's why the original John Wick worked.
Yeah.
They killed his dog. They shouldn't have done that. And then the premise you're in from the get-go, Taken, Liam Neeson, they took his daughter. He's got to go get her.
That's it. You got to
If
do
you
it.
Can explain an action movie in like 8 words, you're good. It's going to work every time.
It's so true.
Well, what happens to Old Man Bourne? Are you still making Bourne in like 2038?
I don't know. I don't know what will happen. I mean. He's at a nursing home. But
Normandy or something. Yeah. I don't know.
And he just can't remember.
He can't remember why he's here, why he likes tapioca.
Can't remember where they left the Jell-O. No, if anybody ever came up with a story, I'd do it. I love the character, but I don't know. There was always that inner thing that propelled him, right? Which is he didn't have his memory, and I think we keep getting it back in stages. I think we've got my memory back 4 times.
What kind of level of CTE does Bourne have?
I know
it's like
really
the last
bad.
Level.
It's a lifetime of cage fighting. He just doesn't remember anything.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
Edward Norton was here a few weeks ago.
Oh, man. Great.
He's in on Rounders, too. Everybody's in.
Every
single person is in, but I have a new plan.
What's that?
Netflix.
Maybe they do it. Yeah, I bet they would. I don't know who owns the rights. I don't know if
that's open on a Friday. People are watching Rounders, too.
I think so, too. I think it would be great.
You could do it in 10 weeks.
I would do it. I mean, I'm telling you. I mean, and I know Edward would want to do it. I mean, we talked about it. Yeah, we talked about it years ago. And Brian and David have a great idea. Like, we really should do it.
Edward seems concerned about what happens to Worm and how much he'll be in it. I don't think he wants to be your caddy. I think he really wants Worm to
Agree.
Be drawn out as a real character, which I agree with.
But I agree that that's what people liked about the first one.
Yeah.
Right? I don't ever feel like, I mean, he got to do this really colorful thing, but he was it felt like the co-lead, you know what I mean? And that's what everyone loved. And it's that dynamic, right? It's that friend you have that always, you know, he's going to screw it up for you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's really, that's, and I
think. But you have the history.
The history is always going to win. So
anything.
What's happened to them, right? I mean, Worm can't have been making really awesome decisions for the last 20 years, right? So what stage is he going to be in? Like, what trouble in, like, the Costa Rican offshore, you know, gambling house is he in,
right?
At the, like, you know, I'm in a bit of a spot here, Mike. They want to kill me, right? It's like something you can see. There are a lot of different ways to go.
Wealthy Mike McD, I think, is... That would work, and then Worm coming back because he needs money,
right?
And he knows.
But also, but meanwhile, there's this other revolution happening in poker, right? Which is the Doyle Brunsons and all those people who were just running the game when we made Rounders, and now the common thing was like, hey, it's a skill game, and these are the best in the world. Suddenly, these kids came up online.
Yeah.
From like Sweden, you know,
right.
Like they've been playing 10 hands at a time since they were 12 years old. And by the time they show up for a live game, they're like AI, you know, they walk in and they're playing. And I was talking to Koppelman about it a few years ago, and he's saying it's the game has gone so deep into like game theory. Like it's just an unrecognizable game, the way it's played by this new generation. So it'd be interesting to watch Mike go back, you know, he was the young kind of upstart who was kind of proved himself worthy in the game. But like now this new group is coming in of like.
It's going to take him down.
Right. And they are taking the game. They're like destroying everybody in their path. They're literally doing stuff with analytics where they're playing hands online the way they wouldn't play them just so that they throw off their profile because people are reading everybody's hand histories.
Right. They're sabotaging their own hands.
They're sabotaging their own. It's what Tony Romo called out Belichick for. It was one of this great calls that Romo had a year ago or two where the other team, I can't remember who we were playing, was coming down. And the game, we were up by 3 scores and there's like 5 minutes left. And Belichick put his defense in. And they instantly, right before they snapped the ball, Roma goes, oh, this is so gross. This is so sick. And whoever's doing the end is like, what do you mean, Tony? And he's like, oh, he never does this. He's just trying to mess with the analytics right now. Like he was literally putting in a package that he knew would get run all over because he was going to concede the score because it didn't matter at all for the game, for the outcome of the game. And because he wanted other coaches to be like flim-flammed. They're like, well, what does he do in this situation? Well, sometimes he does this and sometimes he does that. No, he always does the same thing there, but he doesn't want you to.
See, I believe he does all that stuff.
So I am
still in the corner that the Seattle Super Bowl, which we actually improbably watched together, that he was reading the sideline on the other side. Seattle, he saw the chaos and anyone else would have called timeout, but he saw something he liked and just decided to ride it out. And people are like, that's crazy. There's no way he froze.
I don't know. I mean, he was depending on Butler. If you remember that play, so Butler smacks, was it Tlaib who was right in front of him? So Butler walks up behind him. They were stacked up against each other, right? Now, I never played football.
Tlaib slapped Butler, right?
No, I thought Butler was behind him. So Butler walks up and slaps Tlaib. In other words, to say, get firm on this guy at the line. Don't let him push you off.
Oh, yeah.
I'm coming in right here. Like, literally came right off his ass. And because he recognized it, because Butler had been beat by that play in practice,
right?
And he got a talking to from Belichick. So my recollection is that if that's Belichick going like, I'm going to trust that Malcolm remembers that this happened, and you know that's a.
I don't think he was thinking that. I think he was thinking they seem out of control. Whatever they're going to do on this play is probably not going to work. Let's ride it out. Maybe it'll be a pass. We'll get an incompletion. It'll stop the clock anyway. I don't know what he was thinking, but
he's
staring across the sideline, watching them the same way you would watch like somebody's house from across the street.
Yeah.
I think he goes back to the Kubrick and Fincher and those guys. I think certain people are just different. We're not going to understand them. I don't know what he does 10 years from now. I don't know why
he didn't start Malcolm Butler in the Philly Super Bowl.
We'll never know the story.
Well, I don't know why. I mean, it's like you've won so many Super Bowls. At least tell us. Give us some reason why when they literally couldn't stop us. Did we punt? We didn't punt in that game. Patriots didn't punt.
Tommy threw
for what? 900,000 yards in that game? Like, set every record. They could not stop him. They could not stop him.
Are you worried this is our last year with him?
No, I'm... No. I know
what he's doing.
I don't know. I have not had that conversation.
Hey, man, what's going on?
No. I wouldn't. It's private. It's his business. I would never ask him that. And I don't have that kind of relationship with him. I'm always really happy to see him. And like, I think the world of the guy. But
are you happy to see him because he's won us 6 Super Bowls? Is that one of the reasons?
I love watching people who are that dedicated to what they do. And he works so hard. And most of that work you never see. And I just admire that in people. I admire it in people in any field that they're in that go after excellence to that degree. It's awesome. And it's inspirational, and it makes me better at my job. But I think what's happening with him, like these people, like the decline of Tom Brady and it's his age, like he's in better shape now than he was when he was 24, without a doubt. And they just got to protect him. They just need to protect him. You know, the line, we've got all these injuries. We got people moving around. If you protect him and give him receivers who can get separation, I'll take him over any quarterback in the NFL.
So we're taping this the day after the Ravens game, which I actually feel like they needed, because today has been a whole day of, oh, Brady's old. Pats don't have this is great. We're back.
It's our bye week, and we're going to hear 2 weeks of this nonsense and people screaming at each other on ESPN.
Awesome.
You know,
everyone
it's over. It's over. Yeah. It's like, you know,
coming up next. I'll tell you why.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All that stuff.
No, nothing's changed. I mean, people say, you know, they just look at his numbers and say his production is falling off. And you just go like, I mean, okay, he doesn't have Gronkowski this year. You know what I mean? Like, it would have been, you know.
The Ben Watson play, that was Gronk catches that every time in the second half.
Right.
The 25-yard seam route.
Right.
Watson drops it.
Yeah.
Gronk makes that play.
Yeah. And Watson normally makes that play.
Right.
I mean, that just didn't go our way. But look, there, you know, Sanu was great. And that
Sanu
was
senior.
Yeah, Sanu senior was awesome. That was exciting. And Edelman's always great.
Our set, we have 2 seniors now.
Well, yeah, I know.
It's a big one. It's a bold move to throw the senior
on your own name.
Yeah, I like it.
It's good. But so I don't know. I think, you know, when Isaiah Wynn comes back, like, we'll see, you know, if they can protect him. It's like, you know, I don't know. Would you want to be 42 years old and like,
yeah, I don't know how he does it.
I don't, it's like.
Well, he's the thing I've noticed this year, it does take him maybe a quarter to heat up sometimes. It's the old guy thing, but he's like a car. But he just doesn't take any hits he doesn't have to take anymore. It's like you talk about like Fincher and their brain works. Yeah, he's assessed all of the risk in every game. And it's like if we run this play and it's not there in 2.1 seconds, I'm throwing the ball away.
Yeah, which I love.
I'm not getting hit.
And I think actually younger quarterbacks should look at that.
Yeah, like Baker Mayfield. This is his biggest
issue.
Because
you sit there and you go like, you know, or Jimmy G getting hurt last year. Like you sit there and you go like, I can keep this play alive. Like young quarterbacks try to win the game on every play.
Right.
And what Brady's doing now is what Manning was doing at the end of his career. It's like, I got an idea of how I can beat you.
Yeah.
And it's one idea. And I'm going to snap the ball and I'm going to look and go, nope, didn't work. All right, I'm going to try again. I got three chances to beat you. And that's how they're looking at it, rather than like, it's got to be now. And they run around and they get scrambled and they get their heads taken off or they get injured.
I remember his first or second year, he was scrambling to the right and just got absolutely tattooed by somebody. It was like against Pittsburgh. It was one of the conference people and bounced up. But it was like he would, 5 years ago, those days were over where he would never take a hit like that.
Yeah.
And
I mean, by the way, you're taking a lot of hits anyway.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like when they say, oh, quarterback hits and hurries, like you're still in your 40s getting knocked down by a big, strong guy.
320-pound dudes.
Yeah. Like most human beings have never been touched by a 320-pound professional athlete. I mean, it can't feel great.
But can you believe how long this has lasted? I mean, think about what your life was like in 2001. I don't know what movie you were making that year.
I watched the first Super Bowl.
You've made like 10 blockbusters since then.
But I watched I know exactly where I was for every Super Bowl. And the first one was against the Rams. I was in a Scottish pub in Paris. So we were doing reshoots on The Bourne Identity.
Oh.
And
predated all the Bourne movies,
yes,
the first Super
Bowl. Yeah, the first Super Bowl. Yeah. And it was 2002. So the Bourne movie came out 6 months after it.
Yeah.
That summer. And we were picking up some shots in Paris, and there was a Scottish pub near where we were shooting. And Frank Marshall, our producer, went over and he grabbed me and goes, this is, you know, so-and-so. He runs this Scottish pub. We can watch the Super Bowl in here tonight. I was like, oh, my God. So we get in there, and it's illegal for them to have, you know, be up serving beer at you know, they're supposed to be closed at whatever, 1 a.m. And the Super Bowl comes on in Europe at, you know, whatever time, 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
So we go in and they've got blankets up around in all the windows to like black it out to the outside so no one knows we're in there. And every Scottish person in Paris has heard that the bar is going to be open. So they're like, they're all there because they're regulars at this Scottish pub, right?
Yeah.
And they're instantly Patriots fans. They know nothing about American football, but they're all like, go Patriots! Because the Patriots are the reason that they're allowed to drink till 6 in the morning. So it was an awesome place to see that Super Bowl.
So when you're just filming a movie in Paris, so how are you following sports?
Well, like, I was just doing it. I was in Marseille for the last 3 months.
Like the DirecTV app? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. And watching, you know, watching on a sling box, you know, and watching the game, like piping it into my hotel room through a computer and just watching it. So, but the night games are, you know, if I'm working the next day, it's really tough. I mean, for the Super Bowl, I would always stay up. The second Super Bowl, when we beat the Panthers, that was the night before I shot that apology scene in The Bourne Supremacy. So I was in Berlin. And I had the whole crew over and I stayed up all night because I was supposed to be ravaged in that scene. I'm supposed to be bleeding out. And I'm like, I have an idea. I just won't sleep tonight.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'll show up and I go. And so I did that scene just, you know, having
just banged up,
just banged up and just did it. And it worked out great.
The last time you did the podcast, you didn't tell the story about the 2008 finals when you sat next to the Lakers bench.
I didn't tell the story.
No, you did not tell the story. Can we tell the story? Well, first of all, Phil Jackson told you to fuck off.
He told me to sit down and shut the fuck up. That's what he told me.
So what led to that? 2008 finals, you get into it with Phil Jackson. What happens?
Okay, so we were, I think it was game 5, I want to say. I can't remember now.
I think it was game 4. The comeback game?
No, well, we came back in that game too.
Yeah.
This was in L.A., But the game before, we had been down like 23 points in the third quarter and we'd come back and won.
Yeah.
So that game, we're down. They're at home, the Lakers, I mean, and we're down 21, 22 points in the third quarter. And Paul Pierce just goes full truth mode. And
yeah.
Just goes bananas. And they have this unbelievable comeback. And Wahlberg was sitting, like, we had, our agent has 4 floor seats. And
yeah.
Wahlberg and I asked for 2 each. And so the 4 of us were there. And we're up, we're standing up, and we're the only people on the floor who are jumping.
This is game 4, 2008 finals.
Yes.
Yeah, the comeback game.
And we're screaming, you know, it's you know, we're cheering on the Celtics, as you do. And their run was capped by, I think, Pierce kind of sliced through the lane and, like, laid the ball in to complete the comeback, right? And the Lakers ended up winning that game, by the way. So this wasn't the game where we came back and won. This is a game we came back and lost.
Okay.
But but we won the series eventually. But when he completed this comeback in the third quarter, Phil, by the time he went up to lay the ball in, Phil's already up because he's calling a timeout because he's got to stop the bleeding. And Wahlberg and I are like, oh my God, man. And as he calls the timeout and he just spins on us and he goes, sit down and shut the fuck up. He's so mad. Which I get. Look, it's like, you know, I can't imagine if I'm having a bad day at work and there are fucking right. people cheering for my pain, right? So, but like, we're like, how's the Zen stuff working out? You know, it was great. Anyway, so that was my one factoring into the great tapestry of the Lakers-Celtics rivalry.
What about, but you saw Kobe on the bench too, being hard on his teammates, I thought. That was in there too.
I remember him saying, get them the fuck out of my way. Like, he was just, he had that killer, like, yeah. just fucking clear everybody out. I'm doing it. Just get them the fuck out of my way. And like, when the game started, he ran past us and goes, not tonight, motherfuckers. Like, he was, you know, which is great. That's what you want.
Deep down, you admired it.
Of course. Of course. We all deep down admire the Lakers. We just could never say that.
I'm still getting there.
Really? With Magic Johnson?
No, I admire those Lakers. This current Lakers team with LeBron and AD.
I haven't watched them play yet. I've been out of the country.
But. I did some podcasts before the season. I was making fun of the Dwight Howard part of this. I was like, there's no way. I can't wait for the Laker fans to talk themselves into him. And he's been really good the first 2 weeks. Now the Laker fans are like, hey! Hey, you chucked yourself into Dwight yet?
Right, it's going.
It's good. But the Lakers Boston thing is great.
It's great.
It's going to be there for our whole lives, and we hate each other. And then the Yankees Red Sox thing is really fun too. Although I wonder, like, do your kids, do they care about baseball at all?
Not really. I mean, they care. They see that their dad cares, so they you know.
I don't know what happens to baseball.
I know.
I'm concerned.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't looked at any of the numbers of viewership and stuff. It just feels kind of anecdotally like it's falling off. And yet, you know, talking to people on the film set out in France, the Americans, the people who are our age still, you know, that was, we were following that series kind of online, the Nationals Astros series.
It definitely comes and goes faster. Like, I remember the Diamondbacks Yankees World Series, whatever that was, Game 7.
Yeah, Schilling.
I feel like everybody I knew in my entire life watched that game.
Well, that was 2001. That was right after 9/11, too.
Yeah.
And that was the game where they had just taxed. Buster Olney wrote a really good book about that series.
Yeah, he did. Last Days of the Yankee Dynasty.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why any Boston people like, it's called Last Days of the Yankee Dynasty. I want to read that. But his point, which was really good, was they had just relied so much on Rivera. Because Rivera was just, I mean, the greatest of all time. And he just got to that. I mean, I remember Mark Grace's at bat in the ninth inning of that game. He started it off and everyone was talking about it. And nobody could get away from Rivera's cutter.
Yeah.
And Grace had that beautiful swing and he's just sitting there. And that first cutter came in and it just missed. And I think maybe it was Tim McCarver. Somebody said, like, that was like an entire career of being like a world-class hitter for him to understand that not to swing at that, you know? And Grace ended up working. And Grace, I think, had the most solid base hit in that inning. Because remember Gonzalez's little flair thing.
He was a dinker.
And that's a guy who went from hitting, what was it? Like,
it was like
eight home runs
to
hitting to 57 or whatever it is. And you're like, sure.
Right.
Yeah, what a coincidence. Yeah. You know what I mean? And even he, with that body of his, could only kind of barely get that thing. I mean, it was a very unlikely win for that team. And
Costner was on this pod like about 3-4 months ago, and he was talking about For Love of the Game. And he told this story that I actually thought was going to be a bigger deal. I'm not one of those like, man, I hope this blows up. But he's basically like, they're making him throw 200 pitches a day or whatever. And he was getting help from the Yankee training staff. And by the end of the filming, he had to do this one long day and he just like his shoulder was shot. And basically asked the Yankee trainer, and this was like 1999, like, whatever you've been afraid to give me before, give it to me today. And the guy's like, all right, this is going to make you growl a little. And gave it to him. And Costa went out and threw for like 7 hours.
Wow.
And was like barking at people. And I was like, this is great. We finally have a direct tie to the Yankees.
Right.
During the four World Series, but nobody cared.
No, it had been like the Patriots, everybody.
Oh, if it was Belichick, can you imagine? Yeah. If the New England Patriots trainer had said something?
Yeah.
This movie you just made, first of all, I really liked it.
Good. I liked it too.
I like movies with like stars just being stars and a plot I can understand. What I wasn't expecting was how like gripping the last 40 minutes were.
Yeah.
It's really like,
yeah,
you know, sometimes it's like, oh, I bet there's going to be a big race. But the whole thing is just, and everybody in theater was like super quiet. People are just really into it. It's really good.
Great. Thanks, man. I'm really happy with it. And I don't, you know, it's, you don't get a lot of scripts. It's like going back to the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where it's, you know, an original idea that is not franchisable. It's not, you know, there aren't a lot of opportunities to do that anymore. And they're becoming fewer and fewer. So
yeah,
it was an easy yes for me, because it's a great director, you know, which is the first thing I look for. So Jim Mangold did Walk the Line and Logan. And I mean, yeah, it's just great. And he'd worked with Christian before on 310 to Yuma, which was an underseen, really good Western. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah. With Christian and Russell Crowe. It's really good. And so Jim doing it and then being able to work with Christian, I was like, this is a no brainer.
And he did it again. He created some character that was some new version of Christian Bale.
Yeah. I mean, there's the guy that he plays is a real guy named Ken Miles. And there was some existing footage of Ken and Christian does a really good job of inhabiting that.
Are you ready to hear from the car nerds?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've already...
That's not a real GT40. I could tell because the back... Well, like, they're all going to come out.
Well, we did some press with these car magazines and car shows the other day. And on one podcast, the guy was like, well, you know, or in one of the interviews, he goes, I mean, I liked the movie so much that I was willing to forgive the things that weren't true. And Christian goes, hang on, you know, we were doing the thing together. And Christian goes, what are you talking about? Like, let's dig into that. What do you mean what details weren't true? And he goes... Well, Carroll Shelby was 6'3". I'm like, that's what bothered you? My height? That's the problem? That's the problem?
This happened to you with the rugby movie.
Yeah, no, exactly.
That guy's name? Botha?
No, Francois Pienaar.
Francois Pienaar. Yeah.
Botha's the boxer.
Botha's the boxer. I knew it was a Francois.
Francois Pienaar. And South Africa just won the World Cup.
Yeah, but that guy was like 6'5".
He was even bigger than Shelby. I mean, he was much bigger than Shelby. He looked like a linebacker.
That guy won Le Mans and he was 6'3", crammed in like a 1955 Porsche.
Some of those guys are tall. Like the GT40 had a little bubble on the driver's side and it was called the Gurney bubble because Dan Gurney was pretty tall. And the only way, I mean, I get in that car and it's like, you know, that when the door opens, the roof opens with it, you know? So if you're tall, it's going to take your head off when you shut it. The whole thing comes and closes on you. So even I get in there and I'm like,
it's funny because there's this whole market for those cars from the 60s and 70s. I love those cars.
Like, yeah, they're beautiful.
But thing is, if you're driving any of those around in LA, it's like in any pothole or.
Oh, I mean, yeah. If you're like, not.
Where are you going to even drive that? I guess you'd have to live in the country.
Yeah. And also the systems in them, like the brakes were the weakest link in the car, whereas now they're the strongest.
Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell did that thing about it where he took a car to the test track and you could just override. The brakes are so good now that you can just override everything with the brake, even if your foot is on the accelerator. Whereas in 66, when these guys were racing, those brakes were like melting. Like they literally didn't know if the cars were going to stop and they were going 230 miles an hour. Coming up at a wall, not knowing if they could stop.
So I read you guys didn't film the racing scenes yourself because you would have thought like the actual, you had to do like a mix, right?
Yeah. Well, some of it's, second unit. Some of it's like real race car drivers.
Yeah. So it wasn't one of those things where they had you at the track for 7 months trying to
Christian learn. Because you want to look like you know how to drive, right? You want your hands to be in the right place.
But I'm saying like he's not at, now he's not going to start entering tournaments because all the skills he's learned.
No, that's the thing. It's like you kind of, as an actor, you end up as a jack of all trades and a master of none. You know how to approximate how somebody does something, but that doesn't mean you can do it. I mean, these race car driving is like anything. It's like the guys who are great have been doing it since they were little kids, and that's all they've been doing.
Yeah, they were racing go-karts when they were like 7. What are some other weird things you've learned how to do?
It can be really random. Like the Bourne Supremacy, that scene where she gets shot, where the car goes off a bridge into the water. So I had to shoot a scene underwater where I was in a car underwater and I had to swim upside down and get air in the little corner pocket. And so, it instantly, if you have any tendency towards claustrophobia or any fear of the water or drowning, and I don't have a fear of the water, but I flagged it as something that might be a problem. Cause the other thing is you're going to get in a water tank. They're going to fill it with milk and a bunch of particulate so that it looks like a river, and you're not going to be able to see, you know, so you're taking away like a few of your sense. You can't breathe. You can't see. You're underwater and you need conditions to change to survive. So you're instantly going to go into lizard brain a little bit.
Yeah.
But what they did was they just took me to a swimming pool and we built out of PVC pipe, a box, right? And I did it underwater. Like I put the thing together with the stunt guys, and then we would practice going down and swimming into it and sitting there and then taking my air away. And so it's all of these scuba diving techniques, but I never got certified as a scuba diver, right? So it's like, at the end they were like, you should really just go get your scuba license because you've kind of done everything. But I just kind of never did it. But I learned how to be underwater without air and without being able to see, you know what I mean? And without panicking.
So the goal is to make it look as seamless as possible.
It's always a magic trick. So you just kind of troubleshoot, what is it that's going to make you see how I'm doing the magic trick? So in that scene, it's like, you get all those conditions. You have a bunch of different people who are underwater filming specialists or people, you know, you get the car, you make it safe. Because she's in that scene too. She's dead. She's already been shot. So, but she's still got to hold her breath and get her tank taken away. And you have safety divers with you and a whole system to kind of do it so that, and it's a really exciting, really tense sequence. And it's also a really emotional sequence, right? Because he's realizing, as the audience is realizing, oh my God, she's dead. And he lets her go in the water and she floats away. And it's like, so it's a really important part of the movie. So
Rounders, you learned how to play cards, but you actually liked that.
That was really fun. Well, that was, I mean,
you guys were all in casinos.
It was this really underground game then, right?
Yeah.
There were these clubs and you had to get buzzed in through the door and you had to go look up at the camera, like the way it is in the movie. You had to do that stuff. And Edward and I really got into it. I mean, we were in our late 20s and it just felt really fun, like, and cool. And it was a different world. It's like, you know, you're in New York City and suddenly you take a right turn and go down a stairway and suddenly, you know, you walk in and you hear the chips flying and the people, you know, and it's like, oh my God, this is like a whole subculture that I didn't know was here.
What about rugby? Did you have to learn that whole thing?
Well, I realized right away that there's no way, like, unlike I'd done a football movie with school ties, right? And it's like, all right, here's the play. And you do the X's and O's and you know you're going to run right between the guard and the tackle and you're going to, you know, and it's a very scripted thing. Whereas rugby is just a free for all.
Yeah.
And I realized right away, like, you get the ball goes down and you get in that, like, in the mall and in the thing, and you go, there's no way to ensure that someone's not going to step on your face. And if someone steps on your face with cleats, like, the movie shuts down for a week while you heal.
Right.
And so what we did, like, most of that movie, we were shooting the rugby stuff, and Clint Eastwood had his little monitor, you know, because he's out on the field watching the movie, you know, watching what the camera's seeing, and I'm standing next to him, like, going, "Ooh, that looked tough. That looked painful." So I didn't do a lot of.
You threw the big black in school ties, though.
What's that?
You threw the big black in school ties.
I did. Brendan Fraser just throws me down.
Like, yeah. Would be yet another one. I forget. There's two good football scenes. I actually liked him as a quarterback. I thought he was realistic.
We had a kid named, I believe his name was Billy Shar, and Billy was the quarterback at Syracuse. He took him to the Peach Bowl. And that kid, I mean, it was the first time I saw an NFL arm up close. He didn't make it to the NFL, but he had an NFL arm. And I remember, because we would have throwing competitions, and I was 21 years old. I turned 21 on that movie, and my best was 58 yards. I threw a football 58 yards. I was really proud of it. Billy would throw it 70 yards.
Jesus.
But more importantly than throwing it 70, 75 yards was he would throw it 40 yards on a rope. He threw the first time I did like a deep post, just messing around. We were just kind of warming up. It was the weirdest thing. And I've subsequently read receivers who talk about it. They go, you see the ball when it's halfway to you and you have a lifetime of like knowing how, you know, and it just gets there faster and it goes through your hands because you just weren't ready, you know. And
it's like a car speeding up or something.
It feels like it speeds up. It's like that movie Fastball where they talk about that thing where the people say the ball rises because that's what it looks like. That's the phenomenon for them. It went through my hands and I was like, I saw you throw it. There's nobody guarding me. It's not even like we're just messing around. And it was just this incredible velocity that it had. And I went, wow, that's another level.
Do you ever throw with Brady?
No, I would love to. I would love it. We did the thing where he and Jimmy came over and he threw the ball through the window. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah.
And he put it right on. They put that little sugar glass and that little, you know, little cross. I mean, he put the point of the football on that.
Oh, so they didn't use like wizardry or anything?
No, he threw a ball through the window.
But like exactly in the spot
he just did that. They were like, all right, so Tom, you want to throw it through that window? He's like, okay.
Where's the Kimmel feud stand these days? It's on hiatus? What happens?
No, we're still
going?
I think he still ends the show that way every night. I haven't been seeing the whole show because I've been in France, but I've been watching a lot of his monologues. I usually try to see what he and Molly are up to.
Did we ever talk about how I was working on the show when he started doing that?
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's why I moved to LA, when he was launching it.
Oh, my God.
And the first couple months, we couldn't get any guests after the first week.
Right.
And Leno and... it was basically Leno, but it was just squashing Letterman too. But it was more Leno because it was the LA show.
New York.
And if you're coming to LA, you're going to pick 11:30.
And
so Leno was just basically like, if you go on Kimmel's show, you'll never come on mine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So within a month, we're booking the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire run-up winner and stuff like that. And it was so frustrating. And then at the end of the shows, he started doing them. My apologies to Matt Damon. We ran out of time. It was like an inside joke that we couldn't get any guests.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as he described it to me, when I went to do that primetime thing, it was the first time I ever met him.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's the deal, man? Like, why me? Like, what? And he goes, honestly, he could have said anybody.
Yeah.
And he goes, I think I had a ventriloquist and a guy in a monkey suit as my...
that's what it was like.
And he goes, and I just said, my apologies to Matt Damon. He goes, and I saw my producer right behind the camera doubled over laughing. He goes, and I just started doing it. But whenever I see him, it's just like, you know, he and Molly, you know, who's his wife and also his head writer, she's, you know, they're like, this behaves like no other joke in the history of, it's the same stupid joke. And he goes, it gets a laugh. People are expecting it.
And people must ask you about it all the time, right?
In airports, in everywhere, people are like, you know, fuck Jimmy Kimmel. You know? It's like a constant thing. Like,
what was the feedback for the Brett Kavanaugh stuff on SNL?
I just got asked about that this morning on NPR. It was the first time. There wasn't much feedback
because I thought it was just really funny. Was fun to do like a cameo that you could play this really distinct. I just thought, I don't think those celebrity cameos usually work for them like in that kind of way. And I actually thought that worked.
I did too. I thought that because Kavanaugh was so out of control in that hearing that all I had to do was just do what he did.
Right.
Like that weird sniffle thing, like, you know, that like every time a woman questioned him, he's like, you know, like,
right.
Like what is up with this guy? And so it's you know, the beer stuff, like, you know, it's just, you just.
And the three friends that he had.
Yeah, right. Squee. He's starting to cry. And it's like, oh, my God, this is like.
You kind of dipped into the school ties guy for that character.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And that's
it's the boarding school
exactly
dickhead guy.
Exactly what it is. Yeah. Yeah. You just play that.
So. With the last time we did this, I didn't know, after 2017, you went away for a while. You took your family and you went.
I did. I went to Australia. That was
because there were all these rumors online that you moved to Australia and all this stuff. But you actually did go away for like 9 months, right?
It was like three or 4 months. Yeah.
Oh, that was it? I thought it was longer.
Yeah. It was about 3 or 4 months, I think.
And what'd you do? Just camp?
We did a lot of
camping. Try to get away from civilization?
Yeah, it was right after my dad died. I don't know. We have friends down there for one. And then it was a place my dad had never been. I think maybe there was something about me that wanted to, you know, I don't know. But also so much kind of came rushing back to me about my relationship to my dad and. You know, my brother and I would talk about it. Like, we suddenly started remembering all these, like, shitty camping trips.
Right.
Know, like, where we go to, you know, that weren't, I mean, I say shitty as a joke because it's like, you know, you drive out to the Cape and you get a campground and it's so awesome. And I was like, well, let's, make some, let's go on an adventure. Like, let's do something. Like, we got this time with the kids. Let's go. Let's just go.
And your kids weren't like too old where it would have right. been, they would have killed them. They get pulled out of school for 5 months.
Right. And no, we also, like, we did it this year from, I think we brought two teachers with us. We went, let's go. Let's really, and they were interacting with the school. And so it was like,
oh, that's good.
Yeah. And those, I mean, and we're kind of used to that from movies. Sometimes we'll go and bring teachers who kind of interface with the school, and academically the kids will get ahead. Like, you don't want to do it too much. I mean, just because school isn't just about obviously reading and writing, it's like the social stuff and the negotiation skills and all the stuff that goes along with your development is so crucial to be around other kids.
Yeah.
But to do it as an adventure and to really set it up with them as an adventure. Like, this is what we're doing. Cause they've, you know, we moved back to Boston for that year and my dad was sick at the end. I mean, he was sick for years, but when he was really sick and it was a really tough year, but I'm glad that they got to see that they got closure in I think a very healthy way. And they got to see what a family does. Right. And appreciate that and understand that. And so they understood that trip as what it was, right? Like a, all right, you know, this is our family. Like, let's go.
Right. It seems like you've really protected that family side. Like, people don't know that much about what you're doing privately. And you have about as normal of a family life as you're going to have considering your position in life, you know? Because I think it could go sideways in a lot of different ways.
Yeah,
in the wrong hands.
It can, and it still can. I mean, there's, you know, the online stuff. Like, I you know, it kids will only start investigating. You know, they'll start investigating.
They're like 10.
Yeah, yeah. Like, but you know, which is now. You know, I've got a 13, and 11, and a 9-year-old. So,
that's weird. I remember my son. He was like 9 or 10. He's like, Dad, this thing on YouTube, this guy hates you.
Right.
And I'm
right.
like, why are you looking at me on YouTube? It's like, I don't know. It's funny. Like,
right.
It's
like, right. Right. And, but look, that's great that he says that so that you have that, you know, so that you can work it through with him. Right.
Right.
It's like, but yeah, I mean, that's definitely a consideration. And, cause you just don't want it to infect your dynamic with your kid, you know, or really any of your real relationships, right?
Right.
There's there's the outside world and the inside world. And the inside world is like, you don't want the dynamics between you and the people who are closest to you to be at all infected by this superficial celebrity thing, right?
About that with Affleck a lot, because he's, you know, his life is just covered in a totally different way. That's really damaging, I think, in a lot of different ways, but especially like he's going to get coffee and there's
people
seeing if he's looks all right or oh my God, he grew a beard. What's going on here?
It's really intrusive. It's really intrusive, particularly, you know, because, you know, part of the, you know, recovery is, you know, about anonymity. Right. And that's a crucial part of it. So somebody to be in that situation and have it and have the added pressure of, that whole element is just really, it doesn't feel fair, but it is what it is.
What's your next thing with him?
Well, we wrote something together that, along with this unbelievable writer, her name's Nicole Holofcener, and she's just great. And so the three of us wrote this this movie. It's about medieval France, and it's called The Last Duel, and it's about the last sanctioned duel in medieval France, which was between two knights, one of whom claimed the other raped his wife. And so it's this really movie about perspective. And so Ben and I wrote the male perspectives and Nicole wrote the female perspective. And I think it's really potentially could be really interesting.
So that was the first time you've written something with him?
Yeah.
Since 93, 94, 95?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, 93. Yeah. 93, we sold it in 94, then we kept working on it and it came out in 97.
Because you did you bought the Fritz Peterson thing, which I thought would have been an awesome movie.
It's interesting. We talked about...
I still feel like you could do that one.
I don't know. But I think we will write more. Like it was interesting. Good Will Hunting took us such a long time. And I think we always told ourselves and each other, we just don't have time to write. We're never really in the same place for very long. And then this one we wrote so fast.
Yeah.
And I think it's because in the intervening 25 years, we did nothing but make movies.
Yeah.
So we know so much more about it now. And, you know, it's just our process was so much more streamlined that without even trying to, we didn't set a deadline for ourselves. I'd just show up at his house or he'd show up at my house and we'd write for 3 hours. It's like we'd take the kids to school or do it. And then we'd just go grab a coffee and go sit down and start working. And like, suddenly it was like, wait, we have 20 pages. Like, I think they're good. I read them again. Like, dude, I think these are good. And he's like, yeah, I know I do. I think these are good too. Suddenly we have 35 pages. And before we knew it, we had 2/3 of our movie. You know, and Nicole is every bit as fast. I mean, she's a professional writer. So
yeah.
She's great. And she's like, you know, faster than we are. And suddenly it's like, wait, we have 150 pages, guys. We got to pare this down.
You guys should have gone to like the Soho House and just like when the writers go and they write at the Soho House. Got a table.
we
would have caused a ruckus.
I don't want to do it in public.
Wait, we're now at the point, most important part of this podcast where you tell the Red Sox ownership how awful it would be if they lost Mookie Betts.
We cannot lose Mookie Betts.
I'll give you the floor.
There's no world in which we can lose Mookie. That would be...
I'm more upset about this than just about anything right now.
There is no world in which we can lose Mookie Betts.
I'm still trying to understand it and wrap my head around it because you can look up all the figures and see how much money they make from the team.
Yeah.
I'm sorry they spent some of the money maybe incorrectly or they have some regrets, but I don't feel like I have to lose out on Mookie Betts. Like, I had Mookie penciled in for the next 12 years of my life.
Yeah.
Through 2031. I was like, well, that guy's going to be in my life.
Yeah.
My two kids.
He's
Mookie,
a generational
my wife.
Guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he's got to stay in the Red Sox uniform. The first time you saw him in a uniform that wasn't a Red Sox uniform, do you think you'd cry?
Well, right, you're old enough to remember this, how traumatic it was when Fisk came back on the White Sox.
72.
That was honestly one of the worst.
My code to my house in New York when there used to be a keypad and it was 7227.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was so
because
traumatic.
Because we lost him to and he reversed the numbers. And I just, as a kid, for some reason, I saw that as like, oh my God.
Yeah, it was like so a personal heavy. Attack on us.
Yeah, but it was like, a righteous one. Like,
yeah.
How dare we trade this guy? You know what I mean? It was like, he was the soul of, you know.
Well, it was worse than that because they wanted him to leave and they mailed his contract a day late intentionally, which made him a free agent. I think if that
happened
now, that would have been insane.
But we have a very different style of ownership, brand of ownership now too. Like, we're very lucky. We're incredibly lucky.
Well, that's why I'm so hurt by this. I don't know. I feel like they've, for the most part, made really good decisions.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they don't see this would be bad because you're talking, he's for people under 15, he's the most popular guy in the team.
Yeah.
Just flat out.
Yeah.
He's the high number one, and then it's like whoever's next.
Right,
but I think it's weird they don't see that part. I just hope he stays. My gut feeling is that they'll eventually realize, oh, wait, this would be absolutely idiotic. We shouldn't do this.
Yeah, I can't imagine they wouldn't. I mean, I really can't. They've been really smart about almost everything. They've been very smart. Come on, don't look skeptically at me. They've been incredibly smart.
No, I'm agreeing with you. That's why I'm so confused by this. We've won 4 World Series in the last 15 years.
It's amazing.
They've made good decisions for them. The sale extension was not great. Probably wouldn't have done that one just because I didn't know what his health was like.
Yeah.
But for the most part, they've been really smart. That's why I'm
so
confused.
But tell me this. When they brought Sale out in the 9th inning
of
game 5,
that
was the filthiest thing I've ever seen. And I started laughing. I was like, oh my God. It was the first time I ever allowed myself during any of these World Series runs to say, we're going to win before we won.
Yeah.
You know how you would never, ever do that? Like, I didn't do it when the ground ball came back to Folk and he started running towards first base.
He's going to trip.
Yeah, I was like, it hasn't happened yet. I'm not saying it. But when they brought Sale in the 9th inning, I was like, that is nasty. That is disgusting.
Wow.
I mean, it was just the filthiest thing to do. It's like, we're not going to need you tomorrow night, big fella.
Right.
Why don't you come in and pitch one inning when we're up by however many runs we are? And it's just the most demoralizing. And I loved it.
It was pretty great.
I loved it. Yeah.
But I remember the 06 when A-Rod hit Bronson Arroyo's glove.
Yeah.
And then Jeter goes around third. Somebody scored. And all the Red Sox DNA came back where it was like, oh, we're going to get completely fucked on this call. This is going to turn the series around. We're going to lose because they missed this play. And then they actually made the right call. They talked about it. Francona argued it.
Yeah.
And then it was like, the call's reversed, A-Rod's out, and A-Rod did the whole, what did I do?
Yeah, what did I do?
What do you mean?
Yeah. And then it was, no, but it was like, we're in a new world. Like, I remember like going to the parade in 04. I drove up and from New York with, Lucy wasn't my, we weren't married yet. And, but we were together and we came up for the parade. I said, we have to be there. And my brother's kids were still little. So we went over to my dad's and we were, and they wanted to see him, the duck boats when they went into the Charles. So they were going to go down to the river. And I was like, I'm going to run up to Boylston Street. I'm going to see the duck boats twice.
Yeah.
Okay. They're going to go by. I'm going to wave and wave at all the guys. And then I'm going to run down to the river and I'll meet you. And I ran up by myself so that I could see the duck boats go by. And I sat on the corner and like by myself.
Yeah.
Grown man. I was 34 years old. And the boats went by and I looked at those guys and I started crying.
Really?
I swear to God. Crying. And literally people are like, are you Matt Damon? I'm like, no. No,
I'm not. I'm his brother.
I just look like him. But I was so, because it felt like something had changed forever.
Yeah.
In a really incredible way. And it is that thing in 06 where you go, no, you know what? The fucking call is going to go our way.
Yeah.
Because it's fair. We're going to get a fair shake this time.
I remember the first time during that whole 4-game run, Tony Clark hit that double down the line in one of those games. It was a game 4, game 5, one of the extra inning games. And it landed, and then it bounced into the stands over just rolling around. Right, they would have scored. Right. And I remember when that happened going like, all right, that's weird.
Right.
Normally we get fucked on that. Right. That's weird that played out that way.
Right.
And it was just a collection of moments like that.
So it might be the moment, right, when the Matrix got taken over by like the teenager. It was either that or 16 when the Chicago Cubs win finally and Donald Trump becomes president and like everything just goes, you go like, wait, there's a lot of unlikely stuff that seems to be happening.
I would say the Cubs thing's weirder because that was, what, 6 days before Trump?
No, it was right then. It was literally, It all stuff like it was like, let's just change the dials really quickly. Let's just see what happens. See what happens to these guys. If all of their expectations are totally upset. And we just see how they live. Like, let's see, you know, in that simulation where those versions of those people live, let's take a look and see how they react to this.
What are you going to, you turn 50 next year. What are you going to care about? How's your life going to change? I turned 50, 6 weeks ago.
Wow.
It's fine.
It's good. Water's
it's
nice.
It's fine.
Jump on in.
It's great.
Did anything change?
No. You do. The one thing I thought of was, I'm not in the 18 to 49 ad demo anymore. That's your last year in that demo where you're just going, oh, I'm in the demo now. That's just discarded by advertisers.
I had that conversation with my father years ago, probably 10 years ago. We were, it was Christmas time. I had some movie coming out and we were driving up to uptown in a cab or we would have been in a car if I was promoting stuff. And I was probably going to do like a morning talk show or something. I don't know. But we're driving up like Park Avenue.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the 20s and in the 30s. And we're going by bus stops with all the movies that are coming out. And my dad's looking at me, and he's quiet for a long time. And finally he goes, Matthew, geez, I don't want to see any of these movies that I'm seeing advertised on the bus stop. And I started laughing. And I said, Pop, if you wanted to see any of these movies, then someone's losing their job.
Right.
Because you're not the guy we're trying to get. Like, you know, and we started laughing about that. It's like, you're right. You're in this discarded demographic that goes like, I'm not.
Look at my dad now. He watches all three of those Chicago shows. They're all in a row. Right. It's like Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, and Chicago Med.
Right, whatever.
And he watches them all in a row. And I'm like, which one's your favorite? And he was like, I just like them all. They're all really good. Are we good to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Was that an hour?
Yeah, Jesus. I think we're good.
That was fast.
Ford versus Ferrari.
Yes.
November 15th. And then potentially one of the great best actor categories of all time. It could be everybody.
Yeah, nah,
could be all your peers.
It's so weird. I never thought of this movie like that. I thought of it like a like a crowd pleaser, you know? I mean, and
it's the rare combo. It's the crowd pleaser that's also really good, which just doesn't happen that much anymore.
Right, right. No, it definitely worked out. I'm really happy with it. But it was supposed to come out in June, you know, and they held it for this season. So
I think that's the right move.
I hope so.
It'll work out.
We'll know on November 16th.
Things have worked out for you really since that Tony Clark thing. Maybe even a little bit
maybe
before
that. Maybe the Matrix code got rewritten for all of us.
Matt David, the sequel was good. Thank you.
Thanks.